right, you ready? Okay.
Si vais acabando.
Hello.
Translators.
All right, ready?
Translators.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Egunon, por favor, vais terminando. Egunon eta ongi etorri prentzaurreko honetara. Muy buenos días a todos. Es un placer y un honor para el Festival de San Sebastián presentar al actor, escritor y director que esta noche recibirá el premio Donostia. Ethan Hawke puede sentirse realmente orgulloso, puede hacer gala de una trayectoria profesional impecable, repleta de premios y reconocimientos, y que está compuesta por más de 50 títulos como intérprete. Ethan Hawke ha venido a San Sebastián, además de recibir, por supuesto, el premio Donostia, a presentar su último trabajo, Los Siete Magníficos, un remake del western clásico, en el que ha vuelto a ponerse a las órdenes del director Antoine Fuqua. El señor Hawke está preparado para responder tanto aquellas preguntas que quieran plantearle sobre su trayectoria como sobre su último trabajo. Vamos a empezar.
John, funciona, ¿no? Sí. John Hopewell de Variety. Hago la pregunta en español, aunque no va a ser comprensible, pero bueno. El gran y grande Guillermo del Toro dijo una vez que hacía una película para los estudios y otro para él. Sospecho que algunas de las películas para los estudios, sin embargo, le gustaban mucho. Pero este, señor Hawke, es más o menos su M.O., su modus operandi.
Yeah. A lot of people have that theory. I heard Clint Eastwood say that theory too, one for them, one for me. You know, the truth is that if you don't make people money, you don't get a chance to play. You know, so if you do everything for yourself, you it gets difficult. For me, the trick is my first film that I made was with Joe Dante. It was The Explorers. It was with River Phoenix. And Joe Dante taught me so much about, he came up with Roger Corman and with genre films, and that really it's possible to make a great film in any genre. It's just a question of how much thought you put into it and how much love and energy you put into it. And I'd rather see a good genre film that has a lot of heart and energy and ideas inside of it than a pretentious art film that, you know, claims to be art. So it is clearly, I don't think you can have a long career as an actor without seeking some kind of balance as the kind of movies you make. You know, if you make one kind of movie, it's harder. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Y dirías también que el hecho de hacer películas con los estudios le da mucho más leverage o poder cuando uno se aventura en intentar hacer una muy buena película indie.
Yeah, I mean, for example, Richard Linklater and Julie Delpy and I really wanted to make a sequel to Before Sunrise. This is years ago. And we couldn't get it made. You know, we struggled to get it financed. And then Training Day came out, and we could get it financed. It's that simple, you know? Yeah, yeah.
Siguiente pregunta, por favor.
Good morning, Mr. Hawke. Congratulations for your Donostia Award.
Thank you.
I enjoyed the film a lot. My question is, considering we are dealing with a remake of a classic, I remember actors like Steve McQueen, yeah, Jules Brynner, Charles Bronson. Did you feel a particular pressure while playing this character? Thanks.
You always feel pressure when you are approaching work that people have a pre-existing relationship to. For example, if you play Hamlet, you know you're going to be compared to other Hamlets, right? And if you do the remake of Magnificent Seven, you know people are going to compare you to the one in the past. And the one in the past, people already have a relationship to, so it's very difficult to compete with their relationship. You know, it's funny, if you go back and read the original reviews of The Magnificent Seven, they're terrible. You know, I mean, it's only over time that audiences have developed a relationship to that film. I don't feel that pressure too much because, well, in this specific case, I have such a high regard for Denzel Washington and such a high regard for Antoine Fuqua that I knew we were going to make our own movie. I mean, we were going to use the title, you know, to, in a way, it's a way to trick the studio into letting you make a movie. It's the title is an umbrella. And then Antoine always wanted to make a Hollywood Western. And here we had Denzel Washington, a genuine Hollywood movie star, you know, a legend, to be the lead of, to carry a Western, kind of like John Wayne or William Holden or whatever. And it was wonderful to have Denzel take over that kind of American Dick Cheney's iconography, you know, and to reclaim this Western as a modern piece. I enjoyed it.
Siguiente pregunta, por favor.
Rodrigo Fonseca from Brazil. Yeah. Congratulations for being the great actor you are.
Thank you.
Besides being a great actor, you are also a great director. I would like to understand better your new steps in direction. What are your planning? And if you could give an overview idea of your career as a director.
Well, you know, it's kind of you to ask that question. It's a funny thing to be here to accept an award. Whenever you get a kind of compliment and somebody's, you know, it's 30 years of acting for me. And it makes me ask myself what the next 30 years could look like. Should I be so blessed to live them, right? You know? And for me, a lot of it has been a training ground, I hope, for getting more and more knowledgeable and intimate with film. And I would like to direct more. It's funny, I'm at a place with acting where, to my great surprise, acting is getting more and more interesting to me. When I was younger, I was very interested in being natural and trying to tell the truth of being myself and what that felt like. And as I get older, I get more and more interested in different kinds of people and playing different kinds of roles. But I would be lying if I didn't tell you that I hope the next time I come back to San Sebastian, it's with a film I directed. You know, that's what being a movie star is, kind of a young man's game. And what I think it asks you to evolve into is to teach acting to younger people and to take, I've been exposed to some of the greatest filmmakers in the world, you know. The first time I was at a press conference like this, it was funny, as soon as I sat down here and looked at you all, I remembered being 18 and they sent me to Japan because for some reason Robin Williams couldn't go to Japan with Dead Poets Society. And so I was 18 at a press conference like this and in absolute shock, and I had to, you know, have the translator, and I had nothing to talk about, you know. All I could talk about was what it was like to work with Robin Williams, you know. That was basically all I had to say. And but it sure was fun, you know, to be at film festivals. And one of the things that I so appreciate about film festivals is that it's the one aspect of the film business that truly celebrates cinema. So much of the film business just celebrates making money. You know, I mean, the only criteria for how we define success without film festivals is money. In film festivals, there's quality, you know? And it's your guys' support of what cinema has to offer and writing about it that makes the film community so much richer. And so I've come to value these festivals so much. But now I've completely forgotten the question and what I'm talking about. What's next?
Next one.
Hola, buenos días.
Good morning.
Quería preguntarle, bueno, le hemos visto trabajar con con muchos directores y muchos de ellos son, igual podrían considerarse directores de nueva generación, directores nuevos que luego ya han ido haciendo más películas, pero a su vez también ha trabajado con gente como, por ejemplo, Sidney Lumet en Antes que el diablo sepa que has muerto. Quería saber qué diferencia puede haber encontrado entre ambos métodos de trabajar, un más clásico y el más joven, y qué le lleva a aceptar trabajos de gente de esa nueva generación. Y luego también, como curiosidad, me gustaría saber, usted, su primera película es de Exploradores, y últimamente hay mucha nostalgia ochentera por aquella época. Pues me gustaría saber qué opina de ese tipo de nostalgia. Gracias.
All right. Well, first of all, one of the things, there's a great Marlon Brando quote that I love to think about whenever I'm working with a director, which is, and this is from mid-career when he was really, you know, before he'd kind of lost some interest. He would talk about that a necessity to spiritually marry your director, that you needed, that you were an instrument of their imagination, you know. And so for me, it's a great value to work with all different kinds of directors. Alejandro Amenábar is very different than Alfonso Cuarón, or Alfonso Cuarón is very different from Sidney Lumet. And I felt to be able to be in front of Sidney's camera in his imagination, you know, the way that he worked. I mean, hell, Sidney Lumet got to direct Marlon Brando, you know. I mean, so to touch that lineage and to touch where he came from, live television, a generation that's before mine, at the same time to work with people of my generation, and now probably in the next part of my life, I'll work with a lot of people younger than me. It's how I keep my imagination alive and curious, and it's how I learn. So that's the most valuable part of my life that you're talking about, my creative life. And in regards to 80s nostalgia, you know, the only thing, I learned a great lesson from The Explorers, which was when we were making The Explorers, it was supposed to be a giant hit. They made a movie cost like $30 million in 1984, and people thought it was going to be a sensation. And I don't think it played a complete weekend. Nobody liked that movie, and it was an absolute disaster. And it was a great lesson for me as a 13, 14-year-old, first getting exposed to the film business, because it was a trial by fire, so to speak. Because if you can't handle the failure of this business, you're never going to be able to handle the successes of it. And it's a kind of way to find out what your aim is, you know, if your aim is true. And it took me years to recover from that. I mean, it took me years before I auditioned for another movie. I felt so singed by the fire. But I'm very grateful for it now, and I think it's absolutely hysterical that people like the movie now. They're talking about doing a remake of the movie, and I find it absolutely fascinating. If you live long enough, people like anything.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Buenos días. Estoy aquí. Hola, ¿qué tal? Buenos días. Quería preguntarle, bueno, que reflexionara un poco sobre cómo ha evolucionado su país. Los Siete Magníficos de hace más de 50 años han cambiado porque es una película multirracial, pero en términos de violencia, lo que nos proponen es un grupo fuera de la ley solucionando problemas, y me gustaría que lo relacionara sobre cómo ve usted su país ahora. Y luego, si cree que esta película le gustaría a Donald Trump.
You know what's funny is I bet Donald Trump would like the film, but he doesn't know that what the film is actually about is people gathering together to defeat him. You know, I think it might be lost on him. I like to say that Peter Sarsgaard plays Donald Trump in this film. You know what I mean? One of the wonderful things about getting a chance to remake this film, I was born in Austin, Texas in 1970, right? And I grew up, I probably saw this movie, the original movie, I probably saw it five times before I was 12, right? You know, I mean, it was on Sunday afternoon, and it's one of the things you're watching is Eli Wallach in brown makeup doing a bad Mexican accent, entertainingly so, and seven white guys. Or there was one, there's a Mexican actor, but, you know, it's largely a you know, America is defined as, you know, white guys. And one of the wonderful things that Antoine tried to do with this film, and he lets the film speak for itself. I love nobody, you know, it's only Byung-Hun Lee's character who says, you know, we're trying to navigate the white man's prejudices. That's the only line about race at all. There's no hateful language in the movie about that. You know, that Antoine loves to say this thing, which if Clint Eastwood walks into a room, right, and everyone stops, it's because he's a gunslinger, right? If Denzel walks into a room and everybody stops, you're not sure why they stopped, you know? And it's very interesting. And this, I think one of the greatest ways to speak about diversity or this kind of thing is simply to make a movie where a bunch of people from different cultures got together and made something beautiful. And that's what we try to do. I mean, it's a wonderful experience for me. That, you know, Martin Sonsmeyer is from Alaska. I'm getting to work with a Native American. I'm getting to work with Byung-Hun Lee, who is probably one of the best actors in our group. He's the actually only one who's made a great Western already. For those of you who haven't seen The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, it's just a phenomenal Western and would be a great double feature with our Magnificent Seven. You know, we have Vincent D'Onofrio, great, one of my favorite actors of my generation. You got Denzel Washington. You know, I mean, so you've got a Mexican actor, Manuel. It was a wonderful thing for us all to get to work together and to have the movie not speak directly about race, but just show it. And it gave us an opportunity. You know, every time that somebody speaks out in hate or somebody makes an act of racism, there's, you know, a huge amount of dialogue about it. And what doesn't get spoken about is how often we can work together and how often something beautiful happens. And so I'm proud of that aspect of the movie. It pleases me to make a movie that I think the next generation of young people can enjoy and have fun with. And I think like any good genre movie, it doesn't talk about its themes. It's just that they live as the subtext. And I'm very proud of that. In relation to gun violence, you know, we are, I'm fascinated by this question because there's such a demand in my country for gun laws. It's amazing that we have this kind of relationship. I don't think, you know, art reflects what we want to see. And so I don't believe that censorship would help create gun laws. What's really going to save people's lives is policy. You know, I mean, we've got to get the guns out of children's hands, out of the hands of crazy people. It, you know, that's policy will affect change. And in turn, that will affect our culture. But if you're going to make a Wild West movie, you can't have people, you know, shaking hands and saying, please stop killing each other.
Siguiente pregunta al fondo, por favor.
Hola. Hola. Where are you? Enhorabuena por su película. Ayer he visto que el pueblo del oro, como el Irak, en tu opinión, ¿quién son los siete magníficos para liberar el Irak y todos los pueblos que están resistiendo? Bueno, gracias.
You know, one of the first question we answered here today was about a remake of The Magnificent Seven, right? And one of the obvious answer that I probably should have said is that, you know, The Magnificent Seven was a remake of The Seven Samurai. And The Seven Samurai is based on a very old myth itself. I mean, it's an ancient myth of the meek shall inherit the earth. You know, David and Goliath, a few against many. And how there are so many stories, even in historical, not just fictional, historical stories of small groups of people banding together and helping others. I don't know. I don't know really how to answer your question in an intelligent way, except to say that the movie is telling a myth. It's like a legend. It replaces kind of silly racial obvious thing that the original had of Eli Wallach dressed as a Mexican and puts at the center of evil corporate greed. And I really love that greed, you know, greed is what's destroying the environment. Greed is what destroys ourselves inside. And the way to conquer it is to band together. This is, Antoine used to always talk about the seven samurai, because I think that's largely why he did this movie, and that he used to talk about the word samurai. One of the definitions of it is to serve, and that this movie is about people, outlaws, who are lost, who find themselves simply by being of service to others. And, you know, you could really make a good case to be made that the point of our lives is to serve one another. And so I know that doesn't answer your question, but it's my best attempt.
Por favor.
Buenos días y felicitaciones.
Buenos días.
Yo quería preguntarte cómo ha cambiado la percepción de los latinoamericanos en la meca del cine, por un lado, y por otro, ¿cómo si hay algún héroe o personaje de la iconografía latinoamericana que te emocione o que te dé la curiosidad de conocer y representar?
Well, one of the, you know, Latin America is providing one of the most exciting movements in cinema right now. I mean, I feel that, you know, one of the first questions is about Guillermo or Alfonso. There's so much great work coming from that part of the world. It reminds me of, for those of you who saw the, you remember there's this great documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now, in which Coppola kind of envisions a future where it will be so cheap to make a movie that cinema will become like literature, meaning that, you know, any one of us can write a great novel. I mean, all you need is a pen and a paper. You know, you don't, whereas movies throughout the first 100 years of its incarnation, you need millions of dollars to make a film. And as it gets, you know, we have phones and computers, and as it gets cheaper and cheaper to make a film, then films will get based on the quality of what they have to contribute, you know, the substantive meaning of them, which is making it possible for international cinema in a way never before, which is awful for someone like me because I'm losing a lot of work. No, it's a huge blessing, and it's one of the most exciting things I think about the future of this profession. We're going to see more and more international cinema, and it's going to be more and more exciting. And from more and more different classes, you know, that will be very exciting too. In regards to, you know, Brando played Zapata, right? And I don't think I'm going to get the chance to do that. I think it's politically incorrect. But if I could, I'd like to play Zapata.
Primero, felicidades por tu premio. Y me habría gustado que habría estado el director, la verdad, porque la pregunta iba a ser bastante dura hacia él. Dos preguntas. La primera sería, es la segunda vez que trabajas con él, ¿no? Si no me equivoco.
Third.
Ah, tres. Y la siguiente sería... con la juventud que tienes, la verdad que tienes un currículum impresionante.
Thank you.
¿Qué has hecho para ello, la verdad?
I love you. Before I answer your question, I forgot, I want to say, you know, this last year, to the question before, I had a graphic novel come out that I wrote about the life of Geronimo, and it's called Inde, and I want to tell you about it because I'm really proud of it in regards to telling different stories. And I would, if I were to make a movie and get to play figures in Latin American history, you know, the Chiricahua, which were the Apaches, you know, in the U.S. I would love to play a cowboy in a movie that one of the things that's never really been made is a movie told from their own point of view. And, you know, it always stars some white guy. And I would love to be a background character in a movie that really starred a Native American actor. That would be really exciting to me. Okay, now on to my great career and how I haven't aged. That's much more interesting. No, I've worked with Antoine Fuqua 3 times. The first time was Training Day. The second time we did a film called Brooklyn's Finest, which is kind of like our the East Coast indie rock version of Training Day. We had a great experience on both those movies. And the fun thing is that Denzel and Antoine had made 2 movies together, Training Day and Equalizer. And so this time, the 3 of us got together. And it happened kind of, I wish Antoine could be here too. And I really admire Antoine a lot. And I had a party for Denzel and Antoine when The Equalizer came out. I hosted a screening of it to celebrate the movie. And we were there. And I asked Antoine what he was doing next. And he said, you know, Denzel and I are doing The Magnificent Seven. And I said, who else is cast? And he said, nobody. And I said, so that means there's 6 parts. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, if you don't put me in one of those parts, this party's over. You know, and he said, all right. And so we kind of, over the next couple months, we kind of developed who I should play. So, thank you.
Siguiente pregunta, por favor, fondo.
Good morning, this is Jenny from Barcelona. Hi.
Oh, hello.
Me gustaría saber qué es lo que te gustaría hacer, qué es lo que te queda por aprender desde el punto de vista profesional, interpretativo, qué te apetecería hacer. Y después una pregunta igual un poquito más personal, que es, ¿qué es lo que te da miedo? ¿Qué te preocupa en general de la vida, del mundo? Gracias.
Wow. What am I afraid of? I'm afraid of dying. I definitely don't want to do that. The world is a pretty big question. It's pretty overwhelming. For me, I've tried to focus my entire life on the goal of making substantive, meaningful art, you know? It's a small goal, but I really do believe that in telling stories, making movies, literature, paintings, graphic novels, documentaries, you know, whatever it is, that the arts have a collective power, you know, to be a part of our consciousness and our dialogue with each other. And like a person is only as good as their mental health, so is a community. And that the arts are a part of our mental health, about how freely and richly ideas are expressed. And so I probably will just dedicate my whole life to that. I can't really imagine changing. In regards to what parts I would like to play, you know, it's fascinating getting to work with somebody like Denzel a couple times, because he's doing my profession at an extremely high level. You know, there's a lot of great actors and there's a lot of wonderful movie stars, but there's very few giant legendary movie stars that are also great artists, you know? And Denzel is one of them, you know, and he's done it even with the albatross of race being thrown at him constantly, which I'm sure gets incredibly boring. And he is an example of what can be accomplished. I've been more, like I said earlier, I've been more and more excited by the possibilities of this profession. I have a daughter who's 18, and she's just falling in love with acting. And so I'm also seeing it through her eyes, and it's, you know, the history of humanity has been interesting about, you know, the kind of mentor-apprentice relationship, and how the trick is that the mentor learns a lot from the apprentice, from the questions. I learn a lot from young people's idealism. I learn a lot from their expectations and their hope and their curiosity. It keeps mine alive. Part of why I've tried to do different things in this profession is to try to never be a professional, you know. There's something kind of dusty and professorial about somebody who considers themselves a professional. I never wanted to be a professional, you know. I wanted to come at this with a tremendous amount of love, and I still do. So that's it.
Good morning, Mr. Hawk.
Yeah,
we're here.
Yeah, great.
Good morning. My question is that, congratulations, of course, for
Thank
your
you.
Magnificent career. And my question is, how an actor of your top level is able to, do like great blockbuster movies and still keep afoot in the independent filmmaking? And that is like a very difficult thing to achieve. And you, like your schedule, you tend to complement perfectly.
Well, thanks. You know, that's one of the goals of my life, you know, is to find that balance. There's a great, John Cassavetes had a quote where it's okay to do, you know, to sell Tylenol or do some dopey sitcom, and it's okay to compromise your art as long as you know what your art is, you know, as long as you know what you're trying to get back to. Because often people kind of start compromising and then the tide just carries them away and they can't remember. It's hard to find your own voice. It's very difficult to free any of us in whatever capacity to hear our own, what we want to do with our life. And the busier you get, in a way, the harder it is. And so, for me, those kind of, I have some heroes, you know, and people who have managed to stay true to themselves, and not be defined by, you know, there's something about if you work too much in the corporate world, if you work too much in the big studio system, you kind of get a little trademark by your head, you know? And I've always tried to avoid that, kind of break that down a little bit. But at the same time, I want to be relevant. I want to be part of the game. I want to, it's so wonderful. You know, Magnificent Seven is the most crowd-pleasing movie I've ever made. It feels so good. We did a screening in Toronto, and it felt so wonderful to make a movie that made so many people happy. You know, I felt so proud of Antoine. He really is kind of channeling his love of cinema through love of the Western. And for me, my love of movies is really so total. I love every kind of movie. And the only kind of movie I don't like is one that you can see that somebody didn't put any thought into. You know, that they're lazy about, or they didn't put any of themselves into it. And so Magnificent Seven for me is threading the needle a little bit, the same way Training Day is. Every time I can make a studio movie that is something I would want to see, it's a victory for me, you know? And that's the dream for me, is to kind of make some populist art and then make some more personal art in a kind of constant balance throughout my life so that I get to keep working and I don't make populist art I'm not proud of, you know? It doesn't feel good. You know, the reason why you see so many actors drinking themselves to death or, you know, losing their... But it doesn't feel good to go out and constantly be praised for something you're not proud of. It's a very complex feeling. And it destroys a lot of young people, you know? And so I've always tried to avoid it. And I'm glad that you feel that way. I'll try to record your question and play it back as my alarm clock every day I wake up.
Here?
Yes. Hello.
Buenos días y bienvenido a España. Mi pregunta es acerca de los siete magníficos. Su personaje siempre está pensando en su final. Me gustaría saber, como director también que usted es, ¿qué final hubiese dado a su personaje? Y también me gustaría saber qué otro personaje de la película le hubiese gustado realizar, si no fuese el suyo.
All right. Well, one of the things I love about working with Antoine, so many directors come in with their shot list and they have it planned out exactly what they're going to do. And Antoine just works from his gut. He has great knowledge of movies and he trusts in himself. And if I were able to design the movie and direct it, I would die exactly the way I did, because I'm the one who walked onto that set and I saw that church and I grabbed Antoine's arm and I pointed up at that church tower and I said, I want to die up there. So I was like, can I die up there? And Antoine was like, we had a different death plan for my character. And he's like, Hell yeah! Ethan's dying up there! And they kind of came up with all these reasons why I couldn't die up there, and Antoine made it happen, you know? And I wanted that Gatling gun to... Remember how James Caan died in Godfather? That's, I wanted to go down like that, up on top of the church tower. I thought if you... A character who was so afraid to die had to die in a very grotesque way. And I loved how he fell into the cemetery. You know, so that was perfect for me. It was exactly the way I wanted it. As far as playing any other character, you know, one of the tough things about making a movie like this is it's true ensemble work. It reminded me a lot of making Dead Poets Society. The movie isn't about any one of us. It's like we have to be in a band and we have to play our instrument. And our instrument has to be different from the other person's instrument. And so you kind of have to listen to each other and find what note to play. And one of the things that's most dangerous in ensemble work is when you covet your brother's part. You know? So you have to work very hard not to do that. I'm proud of kind of one of the things I learned on Dead Poets Society. It was a little bit how to do that. Peter Weir was very intelligent, and you have to work in really short gestures, but create a really clear character. And I learned a little bit how to do that. And I tried to apply that to this. It's a little bit like, you know, there's a great Hemingway line where he would write a paragraph and then cut everything but one sentence. And he would take the best sentence of each paragraph and build a new paragraph. And in a lot of ways, when you're acting in an ensemble, it's what you do. You have to create a huge backstory for your character and then just let the tip of the iceberg show. You know, they see one tip of it, but hopefully they feel the weight swinging in the water, invisible underneath, you know? And so I try to think like that. And you know, but so if I had to, I guess I would, I'm jealous of what a good job Peter Sarsgaard did. I thought he was a fantastic, it's very difficult to be an original villain, you know? Evil is evil is evil is evil. But he kind of managed to be bored with the whole thing, which I thought was an amazing choice.
Hola. Buenos días. Soy un gran enamorado de la trilogía de Antes de Amanecer, Before Sunset. Y quería saber si ya hemos visto todo el final de la historia o quedaría algo que contar y si tiene alguna ganas de hacer algo más con Julie Delpy y con Richard Linklater de este tipo. Y también una cosa más como curiosidad, ¿cómo fue rodar en Boyhood? Rodar durante 12 años, un rodaje que debe ser complicado, salir del papel y volver a entrar. Gracias.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Boyhood is Richard and I wrote and made Before Sunset and Before Midnight while we were making Boyhood, you know? So in that decade of my life, I spent a tremendous amount of time with Richard, you know, writing and conceiving these projects. And, you know, those two projects, Boyhood and the Before Trilogy, in a lot of ways, they're very symbiotic because they're both, you could say the main character of both films is time. You know, Father Time is the lead of all four of those films. And, you know, will there be another Before? I don't know. I feel in my heart that there is something complete about the three films. When we finished Before Sunset, I knew we would make a third. I knew it wasn't complete. If there were to be another one, it would probably have to be something new, a different way of making them. For those of you who don't know, what I love about it is that the first film opens with a couple in their 40s fighting on the train. In the background, you see Julie and I, who are young, listening. And then the third film ends with us being that couple, you know? And so there's something, a complete circle about it to me. But that doesn't mean we couldn't come at it a new way, you know, a new beginning, so to speak. The problem is if we wait too long, all our fans will pass away, you know. Rick said to me once, well, maybe what we should do is just wait 30 years and do one in 30 years. I'm like, I don't know who's going to care. But, you know, So we'll see. We'll see. Thank you.
Ongi etorri, ta sorionak, le tengo también. Me gustaría saber a las puertas de recibir un premio como este, si hace uno una retrospectiva sobre sí mismo cuando dio los primeros pasos, ¿no?, como actor del trabajo realizado hasta ahora. Gracias.
Right. Well, how does it feel? It does make you reflective. You know, I mean, I had this thought. This may sound really arrogant and obnoxious. I haven't said this out loud even to myself, but I had the thought, it's like, all right, I've been acting 30 years and I'm 45. It's possible in the next 30 years, if I were to live, if I were to be, you know, so I'd be 75. If I continue to work at a good clip and get a bunch of movies, it's possible I could win the award twice. And I would like to be the first person to win it twice. That's my goal. My goal is in 30 years to have the next 30 years to be more interesting and more relevant and more substantive than the first 30. That would be my goal. It's the only way you can look at it. I remember my grandfather on his 80th birthday, he made a speech to everyone that he wanted his ninth decade to be his best. And he had these goals that he set forth for what he was going to accomplish before his 90th birthday. Now, it didn't go the way he wanted, but but it went all right, you know. I mean, we all just have to do our best. I don't know. I often wonder what is to be gained by being reflective. It helps me make choices. You know, one of the reasons why I like being asked these questions by you guys and doing this is one of the hardest things about my professional life, the one thing they can't teach you in acting school is how to make good choices. You know, actors, we're only as good as our opportunities. And there really is no one to teach you that because every actor has to find their own path. And there is no right answer. You know, whether I do this film or not depends a lot on myself. There's no right answer, you know. Whether or not I could find something in this character to make this a worthy experience for myself is really up to me, right? You know, it's like I've had parts where everyone in my life told me not to do it, but I knew that I had something to offer that role, and they don't know that. And I've been talked into doing parts. I remember, you know, when I was doing White Fang, everybody thought doing White Fang was a great idea. My agents and my mom and, you know, whatever. I was 18 years old, right? But none of them had to sit in Alaska for nine months, you know, training wolves how to sit down. It was boring, okay? And that was the first time I learned, like, wow, okay, I have to make these decisions for myself. You know, it might sound like a good idea, but I'm the only one who has to do it. Now, I'm glad I worked with the wolves, and that was it was ultimately a good experience, but it was not enjoyable every day.
Tenemos tiempo para una última pregunta.
Hola de nuevo. Su último trabajo como escritor es una novela gráfica acerca de la guerra civil de los apaches. Me gustaría saber si hiciese usted una novela gráfica acerca de toda su carrera, ¿qué tipo de color tendría, cómo sería y cuál sería esa imagen?
This is an interesting one to go out on. If my life were a graphic novel, what would the image and the cover be? I don't know. I hope it would be me playing my greatest role as King Lear at 97. That's what I hope it would be, right? You know, with this big gray hair and covered in wrinkles and doing something amazing, you know? That's what I hope it would be. And I hope I never live to see such a thing.
Okay.
Thank you all very much. It was a great pleasure.